Thank you once again. It's a beautiful song, singing praises to God. It's interesting when you go through these psalms how everything is supposed to praise God, even creeping things. And we'd have to think about that one, but creeping things give food to the birds. And I found something, too, in Genesis and going through FI Online this past week. In fact, I was telling Marion, well, before we got to it, I said, now, were the birds in the ark? I said, can't they just swim around out there? The birds in the ark. That was the first thing I said. Then I said, how about the creeping things? I said, can't they just hide out in the wood or something so that they wouldn't be in there? And of course, there were creeping things in Noah's ark, and there were birds in Noah's ark. Should remember the birds because he had a raven sent out, and then he had a dove sent out. But anyway, those little things escaped me. When I went to Ambassador College, you would think that I would have come out knowing everything about unclean meats, but I was in a spokesman's club in Buffalo back in about 1967, I believe. And one man stood up and he said, well, the unclean meats were before Moses. You find that during the time of Moses. And it just hadn't struck me, 4 years in Ambassador College, and it had never struck me up to that time that unclean food, well, meat, had been mentioned in Noah's time. I don't know why I missed it, but I sat there and I thought, boy, I never heard that before. So I'm sure I'd missed it, too. I'm sure it had been mentioned in 4 years somewhere along the line, but anyway, I'd missed it. Okay. Well, as we know, December 7th, 1941, was the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And that was just before the start of World War II, and it was described by President Roosevelt as a day that will live in infamy. In other words, the fame was taken out of the day from what that word means. December 6th, I thought of Pearl Harbor because of what happened on that day. And I'm talking about December 6th, just a few days ago, where the President of the United States, Donald Trump, declared Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And according to Hamas, you may or may not have read this, they're, by the way, the largest of several Palestinian militant Islamic groups. And by the way, they have a charitable organization too, Hamas. They do good works, but they're certainly not good. But anyway, they said that this decision by President Trump was a day that will open the gates of hell. I thought that was quite a statement. And we wonder if it isn't a day that will open the gates of hell. I thought of, when I heard the statement, open the gates of hell, I thought of Revelation 9, where I'll read it, Revelation 9, verse 1 and 2, and also verse 11, where it says, the fifth angel sounded. And, of course, this is now after the six seals into the seventh seal. I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, so the sun and the air were darkened. Then you skip to verse 11. And they had a king, as a king, over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. So we see here that coming out of hell, and I thought the gates of hell is going to be opened. You have the bottomless pit. You have the angel coming down, opening the bottomless pit. And out of there comes an angel who actually will inspire or take over completely the king, the beast, and perhaps there will be another one as high-ranking or just as high-ranking, it'll take over the false prophet. So we are in the days that are getting very much closer to the end time. We thought that this was going to take place back in 1966, 1967, 1968, because the Middle East has always been a time of tension, and in some of those years, even more so. As we watched and listened, if you were alive back then, and for those of you who were not alive, in fact, It's interesting. I came in today, and there were our five girls actually there at the door. And with four of them, I asked them to give me their ages because I said, well, I'm just a little older than you are. And so we started adding up their ages, and their ages was 67, not counting Audrey. If we had her, it'd be 79. But 67 for four of them, and I said, well, I'm older than the four of you total, which didn't make me feel too good. I thought, of course, I walked in and immediately met three guys, all who also are older than the four combined ages of them. I'm glad Audrey was there, because I certainly am not 79 yet. But whatever the case, we have been for the longest time, and I'm talking about age now, since I've been in my early 20s, we've been looking at the formation of a group that will comprise the end-time countries that will wage war against the countries of the South and that will bring captivity to Jerusalem itself. So my mind and your mind, no doubt, noticed it more so than the world. I think the world just passed by this. When they heard this, it's like, what's the big deal? This has been going on forever, and probably for most Americans, I would say we are so disassociated with what's going on overseas and so much involved with the isolation of our own minds in this country and narcissism, the selfishness that we have, that basically it doesn't affect us. It just doesn't. So if you ask the average man on the street, what do you think of what's going on in the Middle East? Better yet, if you ask them where the Middle East is, they probably won't know. You've seen some of those questions. So we in the church definitely are looking at this, and we should be aware, and we are aware, and we know to a certain extent how it fits in. But I thought it would be good, even though we do know that there's a lot going on when you see or read about the Middle East, that we should go over some scriptures today. And by the way, I think there was an article, there's been three, four, five articles on Jerusalem just in the last two, three, four, 5 years. So you might want to go to Life Open Truth and take a look at some of them. If we go on into other scriptures in the Bible, Revelation 11, Revelation 17, we can read about the bottomless pit and the fact that there will be a beast power that comes out of, would we say hiding, bottomless pit? They're not hiding at all, but the demon that has been involved in influencing Adolf Hitler has been chained for a period of time and will be let loose again to do the same type of work. A couple other quotes. It said, the Palestinian ambassador to the UK has said that this decision of President Trump's would be a kiss of death to the two-state solution. Now, we all saw some rioting that took place the same day that this was announced. And you can imagine those Palestinians who were looking for a two-state solution. And, of course, we go back to 1967, where the Palestinians were in control of East Jerusalem. At that time, Jordan especially, I think, was in control of East Jerusalem. And because of the war itself, the Israelis did not want an enemy right next door. And so they took over and have been in control of that city since 1967. But from 1948 to 1967, almost 20 years, you have two groups living side by side, not getting along, but one controlling one side of Jerusalem and the other not controlling one side of Jerusalem. So now, of all things, and to me it doesn't make sense. If you have a nation that wars against you, to me you have the right to claim the territory right next door. It is yours. You won it. They attacked. They lost. You get the trophy. They don't. You know, what team is going to say, well, we want the trophy back? And the answer is, in basketball, football, well, there's some trophies that are just passed on. I realize that. But if you win the trophy, you win the trophy. And the Palestinians don't look at it that way, nor do the other nations of the world. It is I guess, not so surprising, because people just don't like the Jews. They would be a byword. God said they would be a byword. But the nations basically don't like the Jews. There's a real good book out. It was probably written 30 years ago now, but basically it talked about the Jews being the middlemen. They're looked upon as the ones who don't work, but they're the ones who are in the middle, who are arranging the trades and the buying and the selling. And if we're not for the Jews, then basically, again, in general, we're talking here, but if we're not for this group of Jews, the middlemen, then you wouldn't have the trades going on. But people hate it because they make so much money. They make so much money in so doing. So this book was basically, part of it was the rednecks and something else, but I can't remember. I think it's by Sewell, George Sewell. Does that strike a bell? Maybe S-E-W-E-L-L. I think he was the author. I'd have to pull that out and read it again. But the Jews are a hated group of people, and it's surprising to me that the Jewish people in the United States are basically Democrats. Now, why, I don't know, because you take President Obama, and he insulted, in the very first part of his administration, he insulted the Israelis right away by going down to Egypt and could have made a half-hour trip over to Jerusalem, or Tel Aviv at least, and talked to the leaders of the country there, and he didn't. And he didn't do it on purpose. He wanted to show that he was going to be promoting the Egyptians, and some say the Muslims. But he definitely was not for Netanyahu. There we go, Netanyahu. Not Netanyahu, but Netanyahu. He definitely was not for him. How many of you saw when the president or Prime Minister Netanyahu was in the United States talking to President Obama, and President Obama was being corrected? That was quite significant when you saw those two and the expression on the president's face. But you could see the animosity there. And now, of course, we don't have that animosity with our present administration at all. But again, you see that the nations surround in the world do not like the idea of moving to Jerusalem, moving the embassies of all the countries from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So you have that statement, kiss of death to the two-state solution. If you're a Palestinian and you want a two-state solution, as if that could work. Why, by the way, doesn't it work? As I look out here, I want you to think, why wouldn't a two-state solution work? That's because the Palestinians believe that the Israelis don't own any part of the Palestinian area, that they need to be abolished. They don't even recognize them as a state. So why you're working on a two-state solution when the one side doesn't even believe that the controlling country should even exist, that they should be just abolished? That's not going to work. So if I believe that Ray Harris shouldn't exist, and I say, let's sit down and negotiate, it's like, why do you want to do that? And this is what we're looking at. And this is why the world leaders, it's no reason there, because if you take a look at it from just what is believed, you're not ever going to have a two-state solution. The Palestinians are looking for a one-state solution. And they are going to get it. Right at the end time, as we'll see in Scripture. Then Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas warned of dangerous consequences. So you can see immediately there were threats opening up the gates of hell and then the dangerous consequences. By the way, Hamas is in the Gaza Strip, and within one day, I think it was probably one day ago, 24 hours ago approximately, from the Gaza Strip, Hamas sent two rockets over to the Israeli side. And, of course, they got bombed immediately. Not too many people died, but you have the gates of hell, I guess, being opened up by the Hamas right away. Scholar Aaron David Miller, and this is from an article that was from someplace. Let's see. I think this was just maybe from a news article. Scholar Aaron David Miller summarized the concerns about President Trump's decision this way. The problem is that Israel has declared the entire city to be its eternal and undivided capital. 1948, they said that, when there was Ben-Gurion, if you remember him, I don't. I was only 4 years old at that time. But he declared Jerusalem as their city. But anyway, including the eastern part of the city where many Palestinians, that is, reside, and where the Palestinian Authority hopes to establish a capital once a Palestinian state is created. So, the Palestinians can declare Jerusalem their capital, but you cannot have the Israelis saying that Jerusalem is their capital. And the problem is the Israelis have said the whole city is theirs and their capital. So the fight isn't over yet. In fact, when I was over getting the car aligned the other day, the gal was there and it was on my mind. And I said, did you hear about, just to show you how people are really not in the know, did you hear about President Trump declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel? And it's like, you just see the look on her face, and you just know people are out of it. And then I just kind of shut up, and I thought, why did I say that? She has no idea what's going on whatsoever. Okay, well, we have an article, and I thought I'd just take a couple of quotes from Mr. Haefeli's article. This came out, I believe, this past week. If it was a reprint, if it was sent out again, sometimes, by the way, when you read Life Open Trip Truth and you get the article, it's already been printed before or used before. But anyway, if you take a look at his article, you see a couple quotes here and a little bit of background. It talks about the city being founded about 3,000 years ago. Almost exactly 3,000 years ago, if you're talking about Jerusalem becoming the capital of the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You remember where David took over as king and ruled from the house of Judea or the house of Judah for about 7 years, but there was no capital of either that would have represented the house of Judah and the house of Israel. So that's where he came with the city of Jebusites, who even later on were in the city to that day. The Norwegians never kicked them out, it says. These were the house of Judah is composed of the Levites, the Benjamites, and the Jews. Okay, so those three. And it said the Benjamites didn't kick them out. But whatever the case, they took over, and I believe it was in the Bible where you read the story where the one who would be responsible for capturing the city would become the general over David's army. And so they crawled up, I think, the waterway leading into the city, and they took over the city, if you remember the story. But that was the city of the Jebusites. That was taken over. It was a neutral city that time, so the house of Judah and the house of Israel both accepted Jerusalem at that time as their capital. The name is City of Peace. I think all of us know that, and it is interesting. It's a city of peace that would not be a peaceful city for an awfully long time until Jesus Christ would return. Then according, later on down here, and I'll just take a couple quotes from his article, but according to Eric Klein, the city has been destroyed, totally destroyed at least twice, besieged 23 times, attacked an additional 52 times, and captured and recaptured 44 times. Now, I hadn't realized it was that many times. I have read about the Crusades and about the Muslims and the Christian Crusaders going back and forth, hating one another and shedding each other's blood. But I just didn't realize it was that many times. Later on, he said, God has revealed through the prophet that this special city would be a very heavy stone for all nations. Let's go to Zechariah here and chapter 12 and verse 3. Zechariah is a book. In fact, from a chronological sequence point of view, if you're looking at the Old Testament, Zechariah, as we know by just turning to it right now, is the last book in the Old Testament. You would have 2 Chronicles if you take a look at the sequence of books from the standpoint of the law, prophets, and the writings. You'd have 2 Chronicles before you go into Matthew. But just as far as a sequence of dates, then you have Zechariah, well, Malachi is. I'm going to Zechariah here. Malachi would be the last one, of course, in the chronological sequence. But here in chapter 12, you have the second to the last book in the sequence. In chapter 12, in verse 3, starting out in verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. So it is not just Jerusalem. You'll have a siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And we know that this is an end-time book. We go to chapter 14 and we can see that it is talking about the return of Jesus Christ in that chapter. It shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem, in that day, a very heavy stone for all peoples. Now, it's been a heavy stone for the surrounding area for a long time, but it hasn't been a heavy stone, say, in 1000 A.D. to all peoples. Many didn't even know it existed. It didn't have anything to do with nuclear bombs, the destruction of the entire world. However, at the end time, people will be looking at it because there will be enough dynamite power, so to speak, to destroy the entire earth. And people are going to be concerned. All people will be concerned. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. So definitely an end time prophecy. All nations are gathered against it. People will know what's happening in Jerusalem. Of course, the two witnesses will be there, and they will see what's going on, and the beast and the false prophet will be there, and they will see what's going on. Going on from this quote, and it's good for our young people to just kind of pull all this together, take a look at history, what's happened in history, and recognize what's going to happen at the end time. It says, the Jew is currently represent about two-thirds of the residents of the modern city. The Muslims, one-third, and there are 15,000 nominal Christians there who also are not righteous. 15,000 of them. If you take a look at the city itself, you know that it was back in 1948 that the claim was that it belonged to Israel, not only Jerusalem, but also the entire area. But I brought up a history of Jerusalem itself, just Jerusalem, to show us that the prophecy in Daniel 2, which I won't take the time to go to, but to show us how true that prophecy has been. We all remember that Daniel was in that first Babylonian captivity, a young man who ate vegetables and drank water, and that was why he was so wise. Still to this day, you know, if you want to really get healthy and your system's gummed up, then water and vegetables is a good diet for a while. But anyway, it was during his time that God gave him understanding of the prophecy that was given to, or the dream that was given to King Nebuchadnezzar. And the dream was that you would have Babylon as a major power, and this is right after the captivity, mind you, after the captivity of Jerusalem. You have Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, who takes over. And so you had a prophecy that began after the captivity all the way to the coming of Jesus Christ in that prophecy. So I took a look and I thought, well, what do secular records show concerning Jerusalem itself? In whose hands have they been? Because we know in Luke 12 it talks about Jerusalem being surrounded by the Gentiles. Well, you have, and I won't go back all the way to where they go. They go to the Chalcolithic period. So we'll just go to the Middle Bronze area. This would be about 1800 BCE, so basically 1800 years before the coming of Jesus Christ, before Christ, BCE. And you have, of course, a small city not controlled by anyone. Then you've got the late Bronze Age, 1400, then the Iron Age to 1200. But let's come out now to where you see Israel involved, and that would be 1000 B.C. And that's pretty close. This is secular history, but it's pretty much right on, where you have 1000 B.C., where King David conquers Jerusalem. Now, Israel had been in the land before that, of course, but we're looking just at Jerusalem. So we come to 1000 BCE, and what we want to look at is how long did Israel control Jerusalem? And you have to stay with David, then King Solomon, and then you have the early Assyrian conquering of Samaria. That'd be the house of Israel, basically. And then Sennacherib, 20 years later, who lays siege to Jerusalem but doesn't conquer yet. And then you have 586 B.C., where the Babylonian forces finally destroy Jerusalem. So from 1000 B.C., where King David conquers Jerusalem, to 586, that's 414 years. 414 years, if my subtracting is right. And I was able to go to first grade, and I did pretty well in first grade, in second grade. I was good up to there in math. So you have 414 years. Now, what's interesting, after that, what do you happen? What happens? Because you come to the Babylonian captivity. From that captivity until now, how long has Israel controlled Jerusalem? Well, we'll follow it through here. And this comes, well, all you have to do is look up, let's see, just, I didn't put the source, but you can just type in your URL, the history of Jerusalem. Okay, and you can come up with this one. I think it was right at the top. So you come to the Persian period next. So you've got the Babylonian period. Then you come to the Persian period. Israel is not involved, except coming back, rebuilding Jerusalem, but still controlled by the Persians. So you have Israel influence there, definitely, but no control. The Hellenistic period, the Greeks, they control next. The Hasmonean period and the Roman period shortly after that, where the Roman general Pompey captures Jerusalem. Israel has not controlled Jerusalem nor that whole territory yet. The Herodian period, where King Herod restructures the temple. So you still have the temple there, but you don't have control of the city. The Roman period, you don't have control. As we know, during the time of Jesus Christ, the Romans were in charge, and, of course, the Israelis wanted to get rid of them. You have the Maccabean period, right, in that time, as you'll remember, and you have the destruction of Jerusalem in 6970 A.D. Israel has not controlled that area. Jerusalem is rebuilt in 135 A.D. as a Roman city. Still no control by the Israelis. Then the Byzantine period, then the first Muslim period, then the Crusader period. And you think, well, there we go, Israel control. And it's like, no, the Christians and the Jews have not gotten along, and actually there's no control by the Israelis. The house of Israel, the house of Judah, has not controlled during any of this time Israel or Judah. Then you come to the Crusader period, the Ayyubid period, excuse my French, I'm not sure if that's the way to say it, the Mamluk period, the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, the British Mandate, 1917, but the British promised something that they didn't deliver, you'll remember that. The British didn't like their brother, the Jews, either. So it's not until 1948 where the terrorist, Israel was a terrorist at that time. So you think of Palestinians being the terrorists now. Israel was the terrorist and took over in 1948. And then controlled the whole city only since 1967, which is 50 years, of course, 67 to 2017. So in a period of 2,552 years, well, let's put it this way, in a period of 16 years, basically, you have that starting with David until now, and you have the Jews, we'll call them the Jews as a generic term, controlling only 468 years, 414 being right in the beginning. In only 50 years where all the city has been in control of Israel. So 464 years for the Israelis, 2,552 years, we know, for the Gentiles. And the Gentiles were to have basic control. So what do we have? Well, we know that the Gentiles surround the city based on Luke 12 at the end time. So we know the Israelis are going to be in control at the end. We're at the end time. The Israelis are in control and fighting off the Palestinians who want to control. So that's basically the history when you take a look at what's happened. And I thought it would give you a good overview. So back to this article where it says the Jews represent 2/3 of the residents, the Muslims 1/3, and of course the major issue would be the Temple Mount, where Israel does not control the Dome of the Rock at all. And the Muslims and the Jews have been fighting over the Temple Mount, and the Muslims are not going to give it up. And right at the very end, we're going to see some problems that are solved, I guess you could say, from a Palestinian standpoint of view. So let's go to Zechariah 14, Zechariah 14, verse 1. Now, again, we're looking at President Trump naming Jerusalem as the capital. All of us heard the history as we listened to the news that it was back in 1995, 22 years ago, where the United States said, well, we recognize now that the embassy should be taken from Tel Aviv over to Jerusalem because it's capital. It's the capital. And every president since that time, every 6 months, has had to sign a waiver saying, well, let's not go there yet because we're going to disrupt the peace process. And basically, as Ambassador Haley said, after 22 years, the United States has actually hindered the peace process, has not solved it. And not that we're saying that this is going to be a solution. By the way, I heard the other day that somebody voted for, this was somebody in the church, not our church, but in one of the churches of God, said they went out and voted for President Trump to give us more time. And my thought was, the first thing I thought of when President Trump was voted in was that he would be the one to cause a swiftness of the end time to come, because it was kind of going slow and plodding along. And I would thought, my first thought, and I told my brother this, my brother's a Democrat, who did not vote for Clinton and did not vote for Trump. He voted for Bernie, I think. And I should have told them that a vote for Bernie was a vote for President Trump, but I didn't. But whatever the case, my first thought was trade war, because of President Trump saying America needs to be great again, and we're not going to take the back seat. And he's right. You know, we've let other nations step over us. But the whole reason, as I remember giving a sermon right after he was voted in, the reason that we are not great is because of our sins. You know, God would not allow Balak, I believe it was, we got Balaam and Balak, would not allow Balaam, and I may have the two mixed up right now, so forgive me. They both start with a B, so I'm close. I get 50% on this one. He couldn't curse Israel. Could not curse Israel. And I think he attempted to get him to curse Israel three different times. And God would absolutely not do it when Balak asked God to do it. Well, guess why there was a curse over Israel? Balak taught Balaam how to teach Israel to sin. And that was what you want to do is send these beautiful women in and cause them to commit immorality, to commit adultery, to commit fornication. And it was one of the Levites, actually, who was doing it. And Phinehas, who was another Levite, came in and killed two at one time and set the stage for cleaning up. But it just shows you the curse comes when we sin. That's how Israel was cursed, because they began sinning against God themselves. Always remember that. We are a cursed nation because of our sins. So anyway, what we have then at the end time is President Trump, I believe, involved when this power, the King of the North, and we know that that'd be the European Union. And by the way, I noticed it's Germany that has declared, if you read a recent article by Mr. Cahill from New Zealand, it's Germany that he noted where you cannot have employment or you cannot buy and sell on Sunday, which is interesting. But anyway, you have the King of the North stepping in and solving the problem and saying, what we're going to do is just give this city to the Palestinians. The Jews have been a problem. They're stirring up everything. And you can see already the world is going to rejoice, because right now all the world is against the capital being in Jerusalem, except two nations, and that's Israel and the United States. And I'm not sure when the United Kingdom is going to step in and be on our side in Australia, but not yet. So I will gather all nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city's going to be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, and the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Basically, you have a divided city. Remember the east side of the city, the west side of the city. At that time, the city will be united. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations. So we see coming then a period of time where the problem is going to be solved from the world's standpoint of view. And remember, when the two witnesses are killed, the world rejoices. I won't go to that scripture, but everybody's looking at Jerusalem and what's going on in Jerusalem. Finally, the two witnesses being the problem, when they're killed, the world rejoices and they keep Christmas. Well, I just said that. That's not what they're going to do. They give each other presents is what they do, and that's why I said that. But that's what's going to happen. Luke 12 tells us that of the same period of time where the city is surrounded, and when we look at Luke 12 compared to Daniel, we can see that it's a fulfillment of Daniel 12 starting at that time. A couple other scriptures here before we go to what we should be taking away from all of this. Jeremiah 13:27. Jeremiah 13:27. And by the way, did I mention, did I ask you the question how many times the word Jerusalem is even used in the Bible? Did I give you the stat on that at the beginning? I asked one person and they said, Jerusalem is probably mentioned 100 times in the Bible. Well, go to 200, go to 300, go to 400, go to 500, go to 600, go to 700, go to 811 times. Jerusalem is mentioned 811 times in the Bible. So, Jeremiah 13 and verse 27. Jeremiah 13. What I'm saying is not new to all of us, but I'm trying to kind of synthesize all of this down so we can understand an overview and realize what's happening. And there is a time coming when people will say, well, Jesus Christ has delayed his coming. He's delayed his coming. But when we see what's happening, it's like everything is on course. When we understand prophecy, everything is on course. Jeremiah 13 and verse 27. This is why you have Jerusalem surrounded. I have seen your adulterers and your lustful names, the lewdness of your harlotry, talking about Jerusalem and Israel, your abominations on the hills, in the fields. Woe to you, O Jerusalem, will you still not be made clean? So again, it comes back to sin. God is not going to come in and take over a city if they are obeying God's law. There are 15,000 Christians there, but that's not enough. If you had Abraham speaking on Jerusalem's behalf and trying to negotiate with the angels, and he said, well, if there's 10 righteous, will you not do it? And the angel would say, well, if there's 10 righteous, I won't go in. Well, there's not 10 righteous unless there are Church of God people there, of course, obeying God's commandments. And there may be 10. I'm not saying there's not. But they will escape if they are righteous in Jerusalem when all this begins to happen. Will you still not be made clean? And then Psalm 79 in verse 1. By the way, again, you can go through, especially the Psalms and maybe Jeremiah even better yet. I think there's 99 times that Jerusalem is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah. 99 times. So you go to Psalm 79 and verse 1. Psalm 79 and verse 1. Basically, the Israelis do not see this coming. They read the same scriptures we do. And they don't realize what's going to take place. O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. Your holy temple they have defiled. So it's talking about the time that this did take place, because it's happened more than once and will happen. They have laid Jerusalem in heaps. The dead bodies of your servants they have given as food for the birds of the heavens, which has happened with the prophets. The flesh of your saints to the beast of the earth. Their blood they have shed like water all around Jerusalem, and there was no one to bury them. We have become a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and derision to those who are around us. So these are just prophecies. We can read other places in the Bible that basically state the same thing. So what do we take away from all of this? What do we take away from all of this? And that's what's important for us today, because we can say, look, Jerusalem is a city that is wicked, and they're going to be taken over by the Gentiles of this world, and it has nothing to do with us. Well, we're in the end time, and this is how I look at it with the end time. Hebrews 12, and I have this in NIV. Usually we don't read NIV, but I have the translation in the NIV. We see that this is talking about the time when God is going to shake the earth one final time. That's what he says at the end of Hebrews chapter 12. He's going to shake the world again. Verse 1. Coming out of Hebrews 11, where we are to keep the faith and endure to the end. Remember, Hebrews 10 starts with enduring, and we are enduring through trials where we must keep the faith. Just following through from Hebrews 10, 11, and 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Now, why does it say that? Well, because in Matthew chapter 24, the church is going to grow cold. This is a prophecy. at the end time, the love of many will grow cold. And that word love is godly love, which the world doesn't have. We can't have godly love unless we have God's Spirit. So it's the agape that grows cold. And the reason is because of lawlessness. And when you think of the society and the extent of complete, total, well, just think of what's in the court right now and what's being decided by the court. You have two men who want to get married. They walk into a Colorado bakery, and the man refuses to bake the cake for them. And so they sue him, and they win. And the judgment is that the baker is supposed to give them $140,000. They appeal it, and the two men still win against the baker, and now it's in the hands of the Supreme Court. Can you imagine in the millennium anything like this happening, where you have two men who want a cake for their wedding suing someone because they won't bake them a cake? The extent to which our society has gone downhill, we almost are calloused in the society when these things happen over and over and over again. Because it's like, well, a callus on the bottom of a foot. You know, in Africa, I understand that going without shoes, you can build up a callus that's one half inch thick. You can't gain, 12 inches to your height, but you can gain a half inch. So any of you kids who are real short and you want to gain half inch right away, it's a way to do it. But what I'm saying is you get callous to all of the pain, anything you step on, all of the rocks and, you know, the glass that you might be stepping over, you're callous to it. And what we have in the church at the end time is callousness. Because of lawlessness, the love of the church grows cold. So we have to be very careful and not let ourselves come to the point. I think in the sermon last week, I didn't mention Lot as one of the mighty 12, but he could have been included. And he would have been included because he vexed his soul daily over what was happening. That's why Lot left. His wife refused to leave because she was not of the same mind. She was not vexing her soul daily over what was going on. When she looked back, it didn't mean she just looked back, took a quick glance. The statement meant that she was going to miss the city and what was going on in the city. She had an attitude that wasn't right before God. So we have to vex our soul daily over what's going on in society. Otherwise, our love's going to wax cold. So it says, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin of society. It could be, that so easily entangles. And I say the sin of society, and you'll see why in a couple of verses. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes, on Jesus Christ, the pioneer and the perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So, verse 3, consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. At the end time, you find a couple chapters previous to this in the early part of Hebrews 10, where it says, at the end time, we're going to stop going to church so much. And it's like, no, we would never do that. And the answer is, yeah, we could. Now, there's reasons because of sickness and because of infirmity. We all realize that. But there will be this attitude toward the end time of not wanting even to go to church to fellowship. Sabbath is a holy convocation, first and foremost. It's a holy convocation. And I believe that's why, of course, it said that. So you think of the love of many waxing cold towards other people not wanting to fellowship. We either hang together or we will hang separately. Is that the statement? Worldly statement. It's not in the Bible, by the way. You can't find that, but the principle follows. So let's finally go to Matthew 24 as the last scripture. Matthew 24, and see what it says here in verse 45. Matthew 24 and verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant at the end? And through all times, of course, whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season. Blessed is a servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Being involved in what? Being involved in God's work. Being involved with the church. Being involved in growing in character, in grace, and in knowledge. Find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming. Now, with what's going on in the world and with prophecy and what we see going around us, it's really hard to say that Jesus Christ delays his coming. But we can get so caught up in what we're doing that we can have that attitude without thinking about it too much. If that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming. And by the way, I think World Watch would be something that all of us would want to subscribe to. I sent out a sample of it the other day and read what it said. It means we're watching what's going on in the world, which should help us to watch, even more importantly, ourselves and our attitude. Assuredly, I say to you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if we say Christ has delayed his coming and begins to, and here's what happens, the love of many wax colds, right? When we believe that Christ delays his coming, that maybe it's not so important to become perfect so soon, begin to beat his fellow servants, to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will continue or will come on a day when he is not looking. So if we're eating and drinking with the drunkards, we're not vexing our soul over what's happening. We are joining the world. And this is what we have to be careful of. So, as I said in the very beginning, concerning December 7th and President Roosevelt declaring it a day of infamy, we have on December 6th a very important day where it might be the day, I guess we could say, where all hell is about to break loose, using that statement from Hamas. And the question is, are we going to be ready when all hell does break loose?